Listener, did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to target nearly every mood and health concern that you can think of. I'm talking about Mood.com's incredible line of functional gummies. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. Whether that's mind magic gummies for deep work and creativity, PMS support to ease cramps and balance mood swings, or their sexual euphoria gummies to help you feel ready for action and turn every touch into a full body experience. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much anywhere these days, but Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get to the perfect mood. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, listeners get 20% off their first order with code Obscura. Head to Mood.com, find your functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code Obscura when you check out to save 20% off your first order.
This Black Friday, get 6 months free when you move your WordPress sites to Kinsta. Enjoy faster load times, no stress when traffic spikes, and hosting you can actually count on. We're G2's number one rated host for WordPress, for a reason. Visit kinsta.com/BF. That's KINSTA.com/BF. Don't miss out. Offer ends December 2nd.
Listener, released with this episode is going to be a free fireside chat, and I'm going to release one next episode as well. Just to give you guys a taste of what you're missing on the Patreon that just isn't Black Label, because there's other stuff that gets released there too. If you'd like to hear more, head to patreon.com/obscurecrimepodcast. If not, just enjoy the episodes and the fireside chat. For a time in the late 90s and early 2000s, a man stalked the streets of Jacksonville, Florida. He stealthily dispatched of women in a manner of which he got his nickname, the Jacksonville Strangler. Today, we cover this man and his many crimes.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
Listener, welcome to part two of a two-part series. In the last episode, we covered Paul DeRusso, a serial killer and rapist, as he's just getting started. Now, in part two, we continue on with his deadly crimes and his eventual downfall. All right, let's get on with it. In June 2001, a Jacksonville woman was raped in her home. DeRusso was arrested and spent 30 days in jail. He received 2 years probation in a deal that also kept his DNA out of the police database. This failure to obtain his DNA meant he was not linked to other unsolved cases. This was a mistake. This was a major mistake by law enforcement. More people would die because of this. In August 2001, Paul worked most of the month as a school bus driver. At the end of the month, he was arrested for domestic battery. Spent 48 days in jail. Then, Paul was released from jail when Nautica dropped the charges. On April 25th, 2002, Paul was arrested for committing burglary. He was acquitted of the burglary charge by the jury. The judge was rightfully furious and extended DeRusso's probation by 2 years, seemingly in spite. On December 17th, 18-year-old Nicole Williams was reported missing by her family. Her body was found 2 days later on Sotel Drive. She was tied up in a ditch and had been strangled to death. Nikia Kilpatrick was living at Spanish Oaks Apartments, along with Chantrell Green and Sarah Anthony. In the fall of 2002, Kilpatrick and Green met Paul DeRusso one day when he pulled up to them in his red Mazda as they were walking home from the store. Green went out with Paul that night. He picked up Green at the apartment of Sarah Anthony, and Kilpatrick was there. Paul told the women that he sold lingerie, and Kilpatrick went to his car to see it. What they didn't know is they were looking at the underwear of murdered women. Despite the fact that he was dating her friend, phone records indicate numerous calls from Paul to Nikia Kilpatrick during December of 2002. His last call to Kilpatrick was made at 9:03 p.m. on December 29th, 2002. The layers of affairs he was having here is something to behold. He was cheating on his wife with Green, and then cheating on Green with Kilpatrick, all while selling them and their friends the underwear of murdered women. Nikia Kilpatrick's sister, Rhonda Scher, called Kilpatrick's apartment on the evening of December 29th, 2002, between 9 and 10, to pick up her children. The apartment was tidy and welcoming. There were candles lit, and the TV was playing in the background. While Scher was there, Kilpatrick received a phone call. Kilpatrick spoke quietly so that Scher could not hear, and seemed to Scher that she was talking to a man. Scher left, and when she called after she got home, Kilpatrick cut off the call, as if she had company or was expecting company. Nonica DeRusso, Paul's wife, drove him to an apartment off Arlington Expressway around 8:30 or 9 p.m. on December 29th. He told her he was going to watch a football game with friends. This is baffling to me. I cannot imagine asking my wife to drop me off at a strange apartment down the block from the actual apartment. Maybe she was just over dealing with him at that point. Paul returned home sometime after 1 or 2 a.m. Rhonda Scher attempted to call Kilpatrick several times over the next 2 days, but Kilpatrick never answered. Sarah Anthony walked by Kilpatrick's apartment at 6 a.m. That morning, it was still dark outside. She saw the bedroom light on and noticed a strange smell. When Anthony returned from work, she knocked on Kilpatrick's door, but got no response, nor did Kilpatrick answer Anthony's calls later. The following evening, December 31st, Kilpatrick still did not answer her door, and the smell was getting much worse. Around midnight, Anthony returned to Kilpatrick's apartment and beat on the window. "Listener, there are images that haunt us all, the older we get, both large and small. What Anthony saw moments after beating on the window is something that Anthony would never forget, and not for lack of trying. The face of a small child appeared in the window like a ghostly visage. The child's eyes were red and he was crying. It was Kilpatrick's 2-year-old son. After the initial shock, Anthony looked past the desperate child and saw someone on the floor. Anthony could see Kilpatrick lying on the floor with her other son, an 11-month-old, lying on her. Anthony broke in and called 911 from Kilpatrick's apartment, all while holding the 11-month-old, while the sobbing 2-year-old clung to Anthony's leg. The apartment was in total disarray. Kilpatrick was nude and lying partly in the bathroom and partly in the hallway next to the bedroom. She had ligature marks on her hands and a coaxial cable around her neck. A heater in Kilpatrick's bedroom had a cut cord, but the cord was never found. The scene showed no sign of forced entry. No latent prints of value were found. Dr. Aruza conducted the autopsy on Kilpatrick. Kilpatrick was 5'5" and weighed 145 pounds. Kilpatrick was decomposing by the time of the autopsy. She had a cable wrapped tightly around her neck, in a slip knot, and trauma to her head. Dr. Aruza did not find any binding marks on her hands or feet, but this could have been attributed to the decomposition. Sperm was present in her vagina. The cause of death was asphyxia by strangulation. Larry Lake of Gator City Taxi Company trained Paul to drive a taxi cab on January 9, 2003. During this training, Lake and Paul picked up Shawanda McAllister and took her to an address on Arco Drive. At that time, McAllister lived with her boyfriend, Rashid Topi, in an apartment on Arco Drive. On that date, Topi helped McAllister with laundry and then went to school. Arriving at school at 7, Topi spoke with McAllister once on the phone while he was at school. He arrived home at around 9 or 9:30. Topi could not get into the apartment because he had left his key in the car of another girlfriend, Victoria. Topi saw a light on and heard the television. He banged on the door but got no answer, and when he called McAllister from his cell phone, he could hear it ringing inside, but McAllister did not answer. Topi left, went to McDonald's and then Winn-Dixie, and returned to the apartment again. This time, the lights were off. Topi knocked and called again, but again received no answer. Topi attempted to enter the apartment from a window, but heard a black male say, "Shawanda don't want to see you no more." Topi responded to McAllister, mentioning that McAllister was pregnant, and the male voice said, "What, you're pregnant?" Topi asked for his work clothes, which were pushed through the window. At the window, McAllister told Topi to come back at 1 in the morning. Topi asked a neighbor, Shaquita Jones, if he could use a phone because his cell phone battery died. Topi used the phone and then went to the Winn-Dixie, where he used the payphone to call his cousin. Topi returned to the apartment and, because no one answered the door, entered through the window. Topi found McAllister dead, face down with her hands and legs tied together. McAllister was nude from the waist down. A cord was wrapped around her neck. A condom was found on the floor. The cord to the television set had been cut. It appeared as though whoever was in that apartment coerced McAllister to talk to Topi, just to get him to leave, just for enough time to kill McAllister. Dr. Aruza conducted McAllister's autopsy. McAllister was 5'5" and 161 pounds. She had a bloody nose. She had an extension cord looped into multiple knots around her neck. Her feet were bound with a cord, and marks on her wrist were consistent with having been bound. The cause of death was asphyxia by strangulation. At around 9:30 or 10 that evening, Lenita Hicks saw a Gator City cab parked in front of her apartment on Matanzas Way near Arco Drive. Around 35 to 45 minutes later, Hicks took out her trash and encountered Paul running to his cab. 20 to 30 minutes later, Hicks heard a man screaming, "Somebody call the police. My girlfriend has been killed." Daryl Lemon saw the Gator City taxicab park on Matanzas at around 10:20 to 10:30, and a tall, skinny black man get out and walk around to Arco Drive. Around 11:30, Lemon saw the man quickly return to his cab and drive off. The following morning, Kimberly Barron, while working as a 911 operator, received a call from a payphone. Paul told Barron that he had information about, quote, "that incident in Arlington last night," and accused her boyfriend, Rashad, of killing McAllister because she was pregnant and he did not want the baby. Paul refused to speak to a homicide detective and gave no further information. On February 2, 2003, Paul DeRusso was arrested for dealing in stolen property in violation of probation from prior rape charges. When Paul was questioned by a Detective Smith, he testified that he had taken Shawanda McAllister for a cab fare, but denied he had ever seen her again, or that he knew where she lived, or that he had sex with her, that others had murdered Teresa Mack. Paul suggested that Adam Moss or Johnny Parker or Lamar Odom could have killed Teresa. He suggested that Frampton Brown could have killed Nakia Kilpatrick. Paul then directly accused Rashid Topi of killing Shawanda McAllister. Paul claimed that he met Teresa Mack at the hospital and that he had sex 7 to 10 times with her in her apartment. He claims he stopped by to see her on July 26, 1999 and had sex with her. Mack told him that her television was broken and asked him to take it to the dumpster. This is not consistent with witness testimony at the time that remembered it playing. Paul then claims that he was told he could keep the television if he wanted it since it was broken. He then took the television and put it in his car and left. According to Paul, when he found out about a week later that Teresa Mack had been killed, he did not call the police because, quote, he didn't have any information to give them. And he continued, "When I left, she was still alive." And that when he was asked by a detective originally whether he knew Teresa Mack, he denied it because, supposedly, he was scared. Paul also admitted to having sex with Nakia and Kilpatrick on December 29, 2002. The bedroom was in disarray when he arrived, according to him, at her apartment that evening. Paul claimed he planned to spend the night, but at 3 a.m., a man later identified as Frampton Brown arrived, angry at Kilpatrick and, quote, grabbing at her. According to Paul, he was concerned for Kilpatrick's safety, but when she told him she would be fine, he then left. Paul claimed that he continued calling Kilpatrick, but from a payphone rather than his cell phone. According to Paul, he found out 4 or 5 days later that Kilpatrick had been killed. He did not call the police because, quote, he didn't know the circumstances of how she died or when she died. Also admitted that he had sex with Shawanda McAllister on January 9, 2003 in her apartment, the same day he met her as a cab fare. Afterward, according to Paul, McAllister got into a fight with Rashid Topi, who tried to enter the apartment through the window. Paul left the apartment, but later returned and found McAllister dead. According to Paul, he called 911 the following morning, but did not identify himself because he did not want to get involved. Paul DeRusso was ultimately charged for 5 counts of murder, not counting the 2 unborn lives he ended. DeRusso began his killing spree less than a month after being acquitted of rape charges. His pattern involved meeting young, single African-American women, typically through his job, earning their trust and gaining access to their homes. Once inside, he would bind and rape them before strangling them to death with a cord, usually found within the house or apartment. On September 7, 1997, the nude body of 26-year-old Tracy Habersham was discovered at Fort Benning. She had been missing for 2 days and was last seen leaving a party. Habersham had been raped and strangled with a cord. At the time, DeRusso was not considered the suspect, but DNA linked him to the crime. In 1999, DeRusso raped and murdered 24-year-old Teresa Mack in her apartment. The witness reports saw him leaving the scene carrying a television. In 2001, he was arrested in Jacksonville for raping another young woman.
We had found in his criminal history that DeRusso had been arrested in 2001 for sexual battery on a 19-year-old female here in Jacksonville.
And served 30 days in the Montgomery Correctional Center, followed by the 2 years of probation that would later be extended.
And when you get a person like this that thinks he can get away without having to answer for his crimes, then to me, they become very dangerous and they're going to escalate.
On December 19, 2002, the body of 18-year-old Nicole L. Williams was discovered wrapped in a blue blanket at the bottom of a ditch in Jacksonville. She had been reported 2 days earlier. Less than 2 weeks later, on January 1, 2003, relatives of 19-year-old Nakia Kilpatrick checked on her after not hearing from her for several days. They found her dead in her apartment. She had been raped and strangled with a cord 2 days earlier. Her 2 young sons, aged 11 months and 2 years, were found alive but malnourished. Kilpatrick was about 6 months pregnant when she was killed. 8 days after that, 20-year-old nursing assistant Shawanda Denise McAllister, also pregnant, was raped and strangled in her Jacksonville apartment. The scene closely resembled Kilpatrick's murder. McAllister was killed on DeRusso's first day working as a taxi cab driver for Gator City Taxi, and her body was found literally the following day. It seemed at a certain point, he had entered a berserker mode and just couldn't stop. His final known victims, 17-year-old Giovanna Jefferson and 19-year-old Saruta Cohen, were found on February 5th in a ditch near a construction site. A new listener, Chime is changing the way people bank. Fee-free and smarter banking built for you, not just the 1%. Chime isn't just another banking app. They unlock smarter banking for everyday people with products like MyPay, giving you access to up to $500 of your paycheck anytime and getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit. Some old banks still don't do this. Forget overdraft fees, minimum balance fees, and monthly fees. Chime makes your everyday spending work harder by delivering real rewards and financial progress. Earn up to 3.5% APY on savings, 8 times higher than traditional banks. And Chime is rated 5 stars by USA Today for customer service. Real humans, 24/7. And Chime also has the Chime Card, the new card that unlocks safer credit building and cash back with everyday spending. Together, at last. There's no annual fees, no interest, and no strings attached. And when you get qualifying direct deposits, you get 1.5% cash back on eligible Chime card purchases. My younger self would have benefited so much from this. Chime is not just smarter banking. It is the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. It just takes a few minutes to sign up. Head to chime.com/obscura. That is chime.com/obscura. Listener, I want to take a moment to recommend another podcast called Mind of a Monster, The Killer Nurse. Mind of a Monster is a podcast series from ID that drives into the minds of notorious serial killers like Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy, and more. This season, they explore the chilling story of Kristen Gilbert, a nurse who murders four of her patients between 1989 and 1995, and is suspected of killing dozens more. Criminal psychologist Dr. Michelle Ward takes us inside Kristen's twisted mind, uncovering why she kills and how she manages to do it right in front of her colleagues. The entire season is out right now, so you can binge it wherever you get your podcasts. And coming up next, they're covering Israel Keyes, a serial killer who picks his victims at random across the U.S. and covers his tracks with terrifying precision. That new season drops early next year. Don't miss it. Listener, if you like Obscura, you'll definitely enjoy Mind of a Monster, The Killer Nurse. Listen to Mind of a Monster, The Killer Nurse, wherever you get your podcasts. Kings Road in Jacksonville. Police determined that Jefferson was murdered around January 20th. And Cohen about 10 days later. Witnesses reported seeing both women with a taxi driver matching DeRusso's description on the night they disappeared. For these crimes, Paul DeRusso was arrested on June 17, 2003, and charged with 5 counts of murder. On December 13, 2007, he was sentenced to death by lethal injection for the killing of Teresa Mack. As of August 18, 2013, he remained on Florida's death row at Union Correctional Institution. Then, in January 2017, the Florida Supreme Court overturned his death sentence, ruling that the original 10-2 jury vote for death was unconstitutional under state law, which requires a unanimous decision in capital cases. Following a new sentencing hearing, the jury again split 10-2 in favor of death, and on December 10, 2021, DeRusso was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Daily New tonight at 5, a convicted killer and an accused serial killer will spend the rest of his life in prison. Paul DeRusso's death sentence was overturned today. He was charged with killing 5 women. He was only convicted of 1 killing that happened in 1999.
Listener, Paul DeRusso is a remorseless killer. He's never confessed to any of the crimes he so obviously committed, let alone apologize for what he's done. Instead, he sits in his cell, showing no signs of guilt or regret for the pain he caused, the lives he destroyed, and the families he has shattered. He preyed on women who trusted him, women who believed they were safe in their own homes, their own city. He stripped them of their dignity, their future, and their voices. And even after the evidence mounted, after the court spoke, DeRusso refused to take responsibility. There's no redemption in his story. There's no moment of truth. Just a trail of devastation left by a man who used trust as a weapon and cruelty as his calling card. Paul DeRusso will die in prison, and the world will move on without him. But the memory of his victims, their names, their faces, their stolen futures remain in the minds of the people that knew them and loved them. Listener, while he silenced them, their stories continue to speak louder than he ever will. Listener, how are you? So, before I get going on this fireside chat, I just want to let you know that Black Label is coming this weekend. It is an extra large episode of Black Label. I wanted to make one a little longer this month, give you guys something a bit longer to chew on. It's going to be somewhere between 3 to 4 different cases long, with something for everyone. And yeah, so expect it this weekend. I'm still working on it. I have some editing to do and would have liked to release it today, but I just, you know, I want to make sure it's nice and polished. With that out of the way, I want to thank you guys for the overwhelmingly positive response of the last fireside chat that I did. I recorded that in the spur of the moment. I was just feeling a certain way. My wife was out at a celebration of life for someone that had died, and it just had gotten me in a certain mood, and I just pulled the mic out, and, you know, it was late at night. I just opened up, essentially. Now, most of the comments were wildly positive, and I really appreciate that. There were a couple that disagreed with certain things. I definitely understand on my evolving stance with the death penalty. I get that. Trust me. I'm not perfect, certainly. But then there was one person, and this kind of surprised me a little bit. They seemed upset when I casually mentioned my religion, something I don't really open up about because people tend to make a lot of harsh judgments about you if you do. And so, you know, it was kind of confirming a lot of fears I have with that. This person has been a longtime subscriber and always been a pretty positive person on the Patreon, never really had any issue. And then he seemed to take from that that I was some sort of white supremacist. I would ask you to go check out episodes like Matthew Shepard, Heather Heyer, Green River Killer, you know, things like that, right? Go check them out and, you know, maybe remind yourself that I'm not the person that you seem to think I am. I'll just put it that way. So one of the things that was brought up is that the fact that I don't like to talk about politics on the podcast. And that's the thing is I feel like you guys can get a sense of my character through the podcast, and that's enough. I feel like a lot of people inject politics into everything, and I've always wanted my podcast to stray away from that. There are a lot of true crime podcasts where the presenter has a tendency to inject their politics into what's happening. And for me, whenever I hear that, all I hear is me, 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 right? It's just a spotlight on their beliefs, their cult of personality. And that is something I've never wanted. And so early on, I made a promise to you guys that that's not something that I would do. And if you kind of figured things out and the way I covered things and, you know, I try to use compassion and things like that when I'm covering cases, if you, you know, think a certain thing about me, that's fine. But I would hope that you would know that I am not a hateful person. I am a very open person. I always have been. And it is surprising to me that somebody would take that stance about me because, I don't know, it certainly feels kind of unearned. I'll just put it that way. Yeah. So, you know, if you're hearing this, and you know who you are, just, you know, please maybe consider that I'm not the person that you seem to think I am now based on one thing I said in one podcast. All right. So with that out of the way, the other thing I wanted to talk about, because I see this conversation come up all the time, and recently it sprung up on social media, and that's about the morality of true crime as a whole. And this is something that really gets my gourd because I really disagree with some of the takes you see on Reddit and Facebook, etc. The sort of easy take that you can have is that true crime is immoral, that it's rubbernecking, that it's gawking, etc. And here's where I disagree. I think of true crime as necessary. You can look at all these articles that get released today that are like, where are all the major serial killers? They seem to have gone away, right? And while we do have some here and there, nothing can quite compete with the peak that you saw from like the 50s through the 80s, and especially in the 80s. And part of what I think happened is that people became more aware. They stopped hopping into random vehicles. They stopped talking to strangers alone. They became more aware of their surroundings. And I genuinely, and I mean this, I genuinely believe true crime plays a part in this. I grew up watching Unsolved Mysteries, America's Most Wanted, Rescue 911, Forensic Files, you know, the whole laundry list of them. And I love them. You know, they were a huge influence on me. And they made me hyper aware of what not to do, and what to do. And so I would have never been caught doing something incredibly stupid, you know, and that's not to, you know, blame anyone that made mistakes in the past. They weren't educated on this. You know, a lot of television showed the world as this incredibly peaceful and safe place. And so I think people kind of became naive, especially post-free love movement. So you had a lot of women just jumping into random vehicles with complete strangers. And when you look at the stomping grounds of serial killers like the Green River Killer, and the amount of people, we're talking 50 plus, that they had killed, a lot of them sex workers, and a lot of them crimes of opportunity, well, then you can see, man, if you were hitchhiking during that period, your odds weren't particularly great when you were in the stomping grounds of some of these killers. It wasn't a good idea. And yeah, true crime comes around, and not only does it educate individuals on what you should do and what you shouldn't do, etc., but also serial killers start to see, like, damn, this DNA stuff is serious. There's a lot of ways for myself to get caught. And so suddenly, you're scaring killers because all these people that thought they were smart are getting caught left and right and, you know, sitting around waiting for the knock. And then their would-be victims are getting smarter too. And so, yeah, that's where I am on true crime. I'm so sick of this sort of weak, you know, sort of Reddit take that, oh, it's just exploitative, it's just that, etc. I'll tell you, I have been contacted by family members of cases post-coverage of people thanking me for covering the case. And then a lot of times I get reached out to by family members asking me to cover a case. When someone loses someone, there's such a finality to it. You know, it's the end. And some people really do want their loved one's stories out there, you know, for whatever reason. And I think it's very presumptive to assume that, you know, true crime is this thing, you know, that's just a rubberneckers, you know, hobby. I think a lot of us came to true crime in the same way. You know, we had darker interests when we were younger, maybe due to some complicated situations at home. Maybe not the best home life, right? I know I had that experience. And I think it just led me down a path that I was always going to end up walking. You know, people ask me, why do I cover true crime? And it's because it was what I was always going to do. It's what I wanted to do. When it came time for me to sit down and figure out what I was going to write, it was always going to be true crime. It's what flows from my fingers. It's what I was made to do. And I love doing it. And so, yeah, I just get a little frustrated by those takes. I think it's sort of the surface level view. If you just think of it as, like, you know, shock entertainment and that alone, and you don't think that it has any sort of impact socially, yeah, you're going to arrive to that conclusion. But when you consider the effect that it's had on the zeitgeist as a whole, the understanding of serial killers and the social awareness it imbues in people, I do think it provides a service. And, you know, I'm not just saying that like from a stance of defensiveness. I've always believed this, you know, ever since I watched America's Most Wanted as a child. I always looked at it this way. And it really seems like a post-COVID, post-Tiger King type of thing where people view it that way. Now, I will say, I could see someone saying that about Tiger King, because if you don't know, the Tiger King himself, he was given a very, let's just say, positive edit job to make him look a lot nicer than he actually is. They cut out a lot of racist rants, among other things, to sort of make him the protagonist of that show. So if you want to say something like that, that sort of infotainment that alters reality to form a TV series is exploitative, sure, I can see that. But, you know, someone like me, sometimes I'll work a case for a long time. And then when I finish the episode, I'm not always particularly happy with how entertaining it's been. You know, like sometimes I'll finish, you know, an episode. I'm like, man, I hope people find this exciting because I don't twist facts. I tell the facts that happen the way they happen. And that's, you know, the simple angle of things. I don't try to mold reality to create this, you know, mystery drama or whatever, you know, that these shows on Netflix tend to do. I don't know if you know, there was that Ed Gein show that came out recently, the Monster TV series. The series that started out strong with the Jeffrey Dahmer one, where they took a couple liberties, right, to combine certain characters or whatever. But they did overall a decent job on Dahmer. But starting with the Menendez brothers, and then especially with Ed Gein, the creators blurred the facts more and more to create a more entertaining narrative. And that, to me, is a bit wrong. If you want to change the names of the people, you know, involved, including the serial killer, and make your own show, which, from what I understand, the creator of that show also makes American Horror Story, you know, that's fine. But taking reality and kind of pushing it around to fit a certain narrative, that kind of thing has always bothered me. One of the worst examples I like to bring up is Pocahontas. Pocahontas is a, you know, cartoon that took the real story of a real person and they made like a love story with her, with someone that she didn't have a love story with. And in reality, she was a child that was basically abused by her captors. So taking like a victim of that and then turning it into a Disney cartoon, that kind of thing always bothered me. So even like from a true crime perspective, I've never been a fan of that. Which, you know, that's why when I cover cases, what you get is what you get. You know, I'll get through the whole case file. I'll put the episode together. And sometimes there's not that many twists and turns. Sometimes what happened is what happened. Anyway, yeah, I think that pretty much wraps up Fireside Chat for this week. And remember, you got Black Label coming this weekend. I'm really excited to get this one out to you guys. I put a lot of hours into it. It's going to be a long one, and I hope you guys enjoy that. Anyway, I thank you for listening, and keep the fire burning.